From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Today, right to work in Michigan. What, if anything, has changed?
Unions have been losing ground for a very, very long time. The right to work law passed 2 years ago was not a sudden shift.
And then Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics team talks Kevin Orr and road funding.
The state House has now approved one. The state Senate has approved one. They have now said they will not agree on each other's, which creates conference committee.
Plus, defending beef, a vegetarian-turned-cattle rancher weighs in on the future of food.
If we improve grazing practices, we have dramatic ecological benefits that we could see.
And a look back at the very dramatic death of George Washington.
Bloodletting was a major treatment back then.
Those stories and more.
It's been 2 years now since Michigan became a right-to-work state. But unions are still signing up new members, and business hasn't seen any big changes yet. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Today, right to work, 2 years on. And then Dr. Howard Markell is here, demystifying some 18th century medicine for us.
Bloodletting was a major treatment back then.
The very dramatic death of George Washington later this hour. But first,
the city of Detroit's emergency manager, Kevin Orr, resigned that position today. Governor Rick Snyder had a little send-off for him in Detroit. Joining me to talk about that and other Michigan politics is the It's Just Politics team, Rick Pluta with Michigan Public Radio Network and Michigan Radio's resident political junkie, Zoe Clark. So, Rick, you're in Detroit right now for Orr's final day. Fill us in.
Well, actually, as he put it, that as of midnight, he will be unemployed.
Don't you sort of wonder, like, you know, when you have office parties and there's someone going away, like you get a cake? I sort of wonder, like, for the emergency manager, if, you know, the governor didn't get him, like, a Kroger sheet cake.
That's, or a,
like,
Detroit asset.
Yeah, right. And this building is yours.
Yeah, we didn't see it. Actually, the order doing this was signed yesterday, and it says notice of termination, you know, which is not the sort of phraseology that you usually associate with something that should really be kind of a joyful occasion. We should point out that also that the quote end unquote of the bankruptcy, it's something of a formality that, you know, Mayor Mike Duggan has actually had, you know, day-to-day control of the city for a while. It just means that they're going to be spending a lot less time on legal matters, bankruptcy matters, and, you know, now the ball is in their court, although under the supervision of an oversight board.
And, so, of course, not trying to be cliche in all of this, Lester, but look, this is sort of the end of the beginning, and we're now in this next chapter. So the idea that the end of financial problems or anything like that isn't quite there. But yet, at the same point, officially speaking, the largest municipal bankruptcy in the history of the United States is coming to a close.
Yeah, we're going to be talking a lot about that and what the numbers kind of look like tomorrow on Stateside. So it's really interesting.
I was talking to an expert in municipal finance, and, you know, remember that right now we're emerging from the recession. The economy is improving. And so, you know, the lessons that we learned from the Detroit bankruptcy will probably not be applied now. But when we see, you know, local governments running into trouble when we hit the next recession, as of course we will.
Meanwhile, back in Lansing, the lame duck session is underway as the biennial surprise party for Michigan. And so I want to start out with first, anybody come up with a plan to fix the roads that'll actually pass and the governor will sign?
Let's take those two. Let's separate this. Has anyone come up with a plan? Oh, yeah. Oh, there's plans
There's road funding plans, yeah.
it's the inability for the State House and Senate to agree.
It's like the guy in the street with the, you know, with the watches under his coat. There's a bunch.
You want some
of
watches? I got some. You want a road funding plan? I got a road funding plan.
I got a road funding plan.
Let me sell it to you. So what's happened is the State House has now approved one. The State Senate has approved one. They have now said they will not agree on each other's, which creates what's going to be a conference committee. So we will have three lawmakers from the State House, three lawmakers from the State Senate, looking like four Republicans, two Democrats, most likely the leaders of both chambers coming together. They will try to figure out one bill or one measure. And how this will work then is they will come up with one and then they will take it back to their respective chambers, to the House and the Senate, and there will be no amendments allowed. There will be no more negotiations about those bills, and there will have to be a up or down vote.
So, Rick,
well, I'll tell
us
you what it will not be. It will not be the Bolger plan, which simply takes the sales tax on that motorists pay when they buy gasoline.
The 6% sales tax.
Shift it. Right? Yeah, it would shift it into roads. And the idea is that with, you know, economic growth will sort of, you know, cover the lost revenue to schools and local governments, and that would actually pause. It would revert to the current system if for some reason, you know, the money starts running out, and the governor says that's a non-starter.
So that's the House plan. What's the Senate plan? How does it differ?
Well, the Senate plan is basically it's a fuel tax increase. And the governor says that actually, you know, generates the more than $1 billion in revenue that he says is necessary to just make Michigan's roads serviceable.
And this is the sticking point, right? I don't think you'll find a lot of people who will say $1.2, $1.5, maybe upwards of $2 billion isn't needed for the roads. The issue is where that money is going to come from. You know, you've got the Jace Bolgers who say, hey, just look at the state budget. We've got money. Take it from here. Take it from here. Waste, fraud, and abuse. You know, we'll cut here. We'll cut and we'll figure it out. Then you've got others who are going, absolutely not. That is crazy talk. You're going to have to see some kind of tax increase if you're going to raise $1.5 billion a year. And so that's fundamentally what we have to figure out, right? Or what lawmakers, we don't have to do it. What lawmakers have to figure out right now. Let them do it.
Well, what the Bolger plan did, though, was it set up a stark choice, which says the money has to come from somewhere. And it either will come from what motorists pay at the pump, or it will have to come out of some other, you know, a service some other public service, or at least potentially from some other public service. And so now lawmakers are caught between their motorists who are starting to get concerned about what might happen this winter and the freeze and thaw cycle and what that does to the roads, and their school administrators, parents, you know, whatnot, who are saying, you know, don't do something that could potentially hurt our schools.
Right. And the Bolger plan, again, as Rick said, is not going to be the plan. I mean, you even see, you know, the conservative leaning Detroit News calling out this plan, going, this is not workable.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some other bills that were introduced. Two bills introduced intended to complement each other. One would protect lesbian, gay, and bisexual people, but not transgender people, although the spokesman for the Speaker of the House argues they would be covered. And then a bill that would protect religious freedoms in Michigan, and there are big gaps in how people believe that law might be applied. A big difference is there. What's the latest on those two bills?
Well, it's not even the latest that, again, House Speaker Jace Bolger has declared the effort to put civil rights protections for lesbian, gay, and bisexual people into state law is pretty much dead. And it's over that question of, quote, gender identity and including transgender people in it. But the speaker is pushing to have, now it's through the House, it's before the Senate, to adopt a Religious Freedom Restoration Act for Michigan, which is supposed to protect people's religious practices from unnecessary government intrusion.
And really what this is about, I mean, so that's the policy, but really the pure politics behind this is some LGBT rights advocates rubbed Jace Bolger the wrong way. They said they want LGBT rights. Jace Bolger said, nope, not going to do the T. And in fact, you are so against that I'm going to even show you how bad it can be for pushing me, thus the RFRA.
It's interesting, though, that if you're thinking about protecting under the Civil Rights Act in Michigan this group of people, why would you filter out the most vulnerable of the four groups in, when we're talking about this, the LGBT? Transgender people are most often attacked. They're most often discriminated against. And it just seems odd that you would say, we'll do this for these folks, mm-hmm. but not for these folks.
Well, and one of the reasons why the LGBT movement is so steadfast on including the T in whatever protections happen is exactly that. That a few years ago, a cold-hearted political calculation was made with some federal legislation that they thought to get the votes, they would have to drop the T. And it's considered kind of a shameful chapter in in the movement's history.
Basically said since then, you know,
never again.
Never again. That we are not going to compromise. And thus why we're not even seeing an LGB rights being added, because they said, nope, we want either all or nothing. We are unwilling to compromise.
And they have a backup plan that they're going to go to the ballot in 2016 unless for some reason the United States Supreme Court kicks the decision on same-sex marriage back to the states, and then that might be the ballot question instead, or as well as.
But don't look for this to come up in the legislative session to come. We've got even more conservative Republicans. Mm-hmm. It is dead and lame duck. It
more
is
Republicans,
dead
more and, conservative and Republicans. No one is expecting that this would happen over the next 2 years if it doesn't happen in lame duck.
Indeed.
All right. One final thing. There's legislation that would bar local governments from including requirements for community benefits when they're negotiating projects with developers. Who wins? Who loses if that bill is passed?
Well, you'll remember that when we were talking about the bridge proposal, that there were some people saying that the city of Detroit should not agree, should not sign on until there's something called a community benefits agreement.
That the Delray neighborhood should get something out of having this being built, where there are houses.
Yeah, we're talking about the NITC, the big new bridge that Canada is going to pay for, and we're going to help them get the land on the side.
And this would basically say this that now local governments wouldn't be able to complicate those negotiations by negotiating these CBAs, community benefit agreements. And that's not the only one that the legislature is also looking at adopting a law that would outlaw local ordinances that require employers to provide sick time, sick leave things,
and minimum
things
wage
like
as well minimum comes back laws, into the fold.
So who's for this? Who's against it?
It's a Republican sponsored bill, and there are a lot of Democrats who will certainly not vote for it. And
this is pretty much an R versus a D issue, like a lot of them that we're seeing in lame duck.
All right, Rick, keep an eye on it for us, will you?
When I get back from Detroit.
Yeah, okay, that's Rick Pluta with the Michigan Public Radio Network, and Zoe Clark is with Michigan Radio. She's our resident political junkie. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Lester.
Thanks.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. You've no doubt heard that eating red meat is not healthy for you. Beef production is a big contributor to greenhouse gases causing climate change. Well, now there's a book that challenges much of what we've been told about raising cattle and consuming dairy and beef. The book is called Defending Beef: The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. The author was an environmental lawyer and a vegetarian, but today she's a cattle rancher. Nicolette Hahn Nyman joins me now. I know a good number of farmers have switched from feedlots to rotating herds and pastures, and you talk about that. But a lot of beef and dairy cattle are still raised in feedlots, eating soybeans and corn. That means production has to include all that agriculture to produce the cattle feed. How does that throw off the calculations you made on the environmental impact of raising beef?
Well, it doesn't throw off the calculations at all, because my calculations are based on the current system. Pretty much all beef cattle spend a large portion of their lives on grass. So grazing is incredibly important whether the animals end up in a feedlot or not. And what I'm arguing is that if we simply improved grazing practices, you would have a dramatic positive ecological impact, including being able to mitigate climate change through carbon sequestration in the soils.
You talk about the symbiotic relationship of grasslands and big grass-eating animals, but a lot of the grasslands native to the Midwest and much of the U.S. are no longer here. I mean, a lot of the grasslands today are not the deep-rooted prairie grasses. They're more shallow-root Eurasian grasses. And the big grass-eating animals today are not bison. They're domestic cattle. So can you explain your suggestion that we've got the same thing going on today when we've got very different elements?
It's true. A lot of the native grasslands have been displaced. There's a large portion of the United States that was always grasslands that still is today. But there are also areas that were not historically grasslands that now are, and there are areas that were grasslands that are now, developed. But it remains the case that a large portion of the globe, about 40% of it today, is grassland. And that everything that exists in those grasslands, starting from the soil up, all of the microorganisms in the soil, and all of the vegetation that exists in those grasslands, and then all of the animal and plant life that depends on those areas, you have to have those ecosystems function properly, the grazing animals. That's the argument that I make. And it really goes way back, sort of from a geological perspective. In order to have properly functioning grassland ecosystems, you have to have the grazing animals as part of that. We don't have the wild animals. And there were enormous numbers of grazing animals covering the globe. So what I argue is that in order to make those ecosystems function properly, whether those are the exact same grasslands that existed historically or not, we still need those large grazing animals. And since we are probably not ever going to have huge herds of wild animals again on the globe, the best thing to do is to use the domesticated animals as the proxy. That's what cattle represent. They represent the opportunity to recreate properly functioning ecosystems.
Let's talk about the health aspects. You write there are a lot of conflicting studies about beef consumption and its impact on health. Can you briefly outline the main points that you're trying to make in the book?
There were decades of public health messages and medical messages that we've all heard that suggested that red meat is bad for our health, primarily based on the suggestion that saturated fat causes heart disease and other problems. That research was started in the 1950s, and there was a good basis for it at the time. But as the cardiologist at Harvard School of Public Health, Darius Mosafarian, says, the science is better now, and we now know that that's really not true. I cite his research and many others in my book showing there are probably other major factors that have shifted in the diet that are the reasons for the rise in diabetes, obesity, heart disease, et cetera, that we're seeing now. And most likely, I think there's very good evidence that it's actually sugar that is much more likely to be the responsible agent in the diet, maybe grain as well. We've had a dramatic rise in grain consumption in the United States over the last few decades. And I think these shifts, as well as the way we're eating processed foods, fast food, we're eating snacks, we're not eating meals. We've had a lot of shifts in our diet. I think that red meat and saturated fat have been wrongly blamed for a lot of the health impacts.
I do want to ask you about one other thing that wasn't in your book, but I think since your book's name is Defending Beef, we have to look at it. The beef industry has lobbied for so-called agriculture disparagement laws and filed lawsuits against reporters and even Oprah Winfrey for statements that the beef industry didn't like. As someone who raises cattle, what do you think of that approach?
I think it's absurd. As you say, that's been going on for a while. That started back when I was still working for Bobby Kennedy, and I actually wrote some memos to him about this issue. They call them veggie libel laws. I have actively spoken out against those in many contexts. You know, the food system needs transparency. We need sustainability from an ecological perspective, and we need information to be available to consumers, and we absolutely need transparency. Those veggie libel laws are going totally against that view. I think that's going against sustainable and healthful practices. And I think there's nothing good about keeping information away from consumers.
Nicolette Hahn-Nyman is the author of Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. It's published by the Chelsea Green Publishing Company. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Creation.
Curiosity.
The next idea.
We weren't setting out to do these huge things. We were just starting with solving a problem we hoped a few other people had.
You know, we're always hearing about Silicon Valley startups, and we get the idea that entrepreneurship is thriving in America. But the reality is, U.S. entrepreneurship has been on a pretty steep decline for 30 years now. The Next Idea team got to wondering about that, so we asked Stuart Thornhill to write an essay about entrepreneurship. He's a professor who teaches entrepreneurship. So let's talk about this downward trend. This is based on census data, but what does this trend really mean? What's happening that we're seeing a downturn in entrepreneurship?
There are actually two data points that are really important in this conversation. One is the rate of business closures. So every year, year in and year out, and again, this goes back for decades, roughly 10% of companies, of businesses, shut their doors every year. And that's pretty steady. Sometimes it's 9.5, sometimes it's 10.2, but call it 10% is the average closure rate of businesses. Now, historically, the rate of business startups or the number of companies that came into being within a year has always been up into the teens. So even if 10% were closing, there were already going to be 15 or 16% that were opening, so we had net growth. In the past 2 years, those lines have crossed for the first time. So in 2013, and I expect we'll see again in 2014, while the closure rate stayed where it was at 10%, the startup rate has dropped into the eights and nines. And so that means we're actually losing companies across the entire economy. And because the companies that are starting tend to be smaller than the ones that are starting, that also represents net job loss in the small business sector. So a couple of really disturbing issues there. Now, why is it happening? I think there are a couple of trends that we can point to straight away, and I think there's more to be learned. One of those trends is the decline in personal savings rates. If you're going to start a business, or I'm going to start a business, we usually need a little bit of money to get that storefront rented or buy some inventory or work on our prototype in our garage, whatever we're doing. And that takes some money. As individuals' personal savings rates have gotten lower and lower, fewer people have that nest egg set aside that they can invest in starting their business. And the next place that people go after their own personal savings to start a company is family and friends. Well, chances are your family and friends are in the same situation you're in because we tend to have family and friends in the same socioeconomic group.
And bank loans are tight these days.
Banks don't lend
for startups anyway.
I mean they lend against collateral, and if you don't have something that you can mortgage against, you're not going to get money from a bank.
So we're seeing this trend going. We're seeing this entrepreneurial trend going downward. But why should we care? Why should society at large really care about that? Especially if you know I have no intention of opening my own business anyway.
I think there's at least two reasons, both of which are important. One, every big company, and big companies, by the way, provide the lion's share of jobs in this country. But every big company started as a startup at some point, whether it's IBM or Hewlett-Packard or Facebook only a few years ago. These companies started in somebody's dorm room or garage or backyard. And without a continual resupply of those startups to replace the ones that are leaving the economy as they become outdated, their technology is no longer competitive, right? This continual turnover, without a steady supply and a growing supply of new companies, it's going to be very difficult to grow the economy and grow the level of employment. And those are critical. And the second is that's where innovation comes from. Those big companies are very good at a lot of things, but coming up with the next new great innovation, those usually come from the entrepreneurial startups. And so whether it's high-level economic growth or what's the next best thing going to be, you really want to look to the startups for both of those.
You, in your essay, say there's a couple of different points that need to be established in getting people into an entrepreneurial mindset. It seems to me that if you're without capital, getting to an entrepreneurial mindset isn't really going to get you very far. You've got to have more than inspiration and a little bit of knowledge. You've got to have cash.
Well, this is really where it comes back to how do we teach entrepreneurship? Because one of the fundamental principles we teach is really starting out with the tiniest little increment that you can. Just take that idea, for example, and share it with a friend or a coworker. I often say the most risky time for any new business venture is when it's just an idea in your head. You haven't told your spouse or your best friend or your coworker about it. It's an idea in your head. You haven't done anything. It can't be any riskier than that. As soon as you share it with one person and get some feedback, hey, that's a great idea, or hey, that would be even better if, and you get a suggestion to it, now it's a better idea. You've validated it with at least one person, and you've begun the gradual and inexorable process of de-risking the idea. Because I think another one of the great myths about entrepreneurs is that they love risk. They hate risk. They want to take risk away from their business as much as they can. And so we try to show people how they can, in small little steps, little increments, try something, make a little something, sell a little something. Just take these little steps, these little experiments, learn from them, improve the product, and do it in a way that doesn't require a huge amount of money, but just be patient and let it grow and see where it takes you. And I think that's to use the phrase mindset in this context, it's really having that belief that it's okay to try, it's okay to fail, it's okay to modify the idea. You don't have to stick to your original concept, but be willing to take that feedback and to try to make it better.
So if we want to encourage that kind of entrepreneurship in my town or my neighborhood or maybe just my neighbor, how would I go about doing that? I mean, is it just a matter of saying, yeah, Frank, I think that's a great idea. You ought to try a sample of that and see what happens? Or is it more than that? Should it be more formal?
It shouldn't absolutely not be any more formal than it needs to be. We've done an exercise in the classroom for a number of years where students would have $10 and a week to see how much money they could make. And one of the best teams I worked with, I think they ended up making about $750 profit in a week. And what they did simply was they took their $10 and they bought a couple little potting plants. So this was around Easter, and some soil, a little seed pack, and some cellophane to make it look pretty. So instead of parents or grandparents or uncles giving chocolate at Easter, which, you know, with greater emphasis on health was important. This was a chance to plant some seeds, some springtime seeds, and grow a little plant. And it cost them $2.50 worth of material, and they sold it for 8 or 10. And so for everyone they sold, they then took all of their profits and bought. The next day they had 10 planters to sell, and the next day they had 40. And they did that every day for a week, and every person on the team, it was their job to take their share of the little planters and sell them. And that meant knocking on doors, standing in the parking lot at Home Depot. And what they all came back with was this newly discovered ability that they could actually sell something they'd made. And the transformation, even though it sounds trivial, was pretty extraordinary, because they then saw themselves as entrepreneurs, and that's a game changer, is how you see yourself.
You gave a nice example in the entrepreneurs class in your college, but if you don't have that kind of setting, how might you do that in your local community? Do you suggest to the scout leader or to maybe the Sunday school teacher, hey, here's a side project you could be doing with the kids? How do you do that in a community?
I think those are two great suggestions, and they both have the beauty that you already have the group organized. They're coming together at a time and place. They're expecting to collaborate and cooperate on projects where they're learning together. So you already have the perfect setting, whether, again, it's Boy Scouts, Girl Guides, Sunday school, any of those kinds of environments are ready-made for this. But just as easily, you can craft one. Rent a room at a library or community center, stick up a couple of posters or send something out on a Twitter feed or an email thread, invite people in, and right away you have all the ingredients is people with a willingness to learn, a little bit of time and effort to put into it, and little, if any, money, because it's really about trying to pull together what you can. One of the other examples I often use in the classroom is when you're making dinner. It's very rare that you put on a dinner party where you go out and you have this long ingredient list and this huge number of guests and this big elaborate procedure where you're trying to prepare a meal. Most times what you're trying to do is go home, you open your fridge, you look at what's in there, and you see what you can assemble given what you have at your disposal. And for starting entrepreneurs, that's where we suggest that they start, is think about what can you do? What are the skills that you have? What do you know how to do? What do your friends know how to do within the group of 5 or 6 of you maybe getting together as a team? What are some, you know, your superpowers, right? What are the skills that you have that you can use to make something that someone else would value? And start there. Start with what you know.
Now, some people are more risk averse than others. Either they just feel like they can't risk any money, or they simply don't want to fail. People don't like that feeling. How does failure play into entrepreneurship?
Well, first of all, it's central. It's one of those interesting things that I think more and more now, particularly if you go to places like Silicon Valley, in some cases they don't take you seriously until you've failed a couple of times. Hmm. Somebody shows up and have a couple of failed businesses on their resume. That's not a black mark. That's a signal that, okay, now you probably know what you're doing. You've figured it out through those failures. So failure in and of itself, it shouldn't be considered a stigma or an impediment to going forward. It's natural, and failure rates are such that it's in some cases almost inevitable. And I won't downplay the fact that failing sucks. It is not fun. It's emotionally draining. It is very hard to live with when it's happening. And this is where this question of mindset comes in, because the two dominant types of mindsets that we've learned about are those that will embrace failure as an opportunity to improve, learn from the failure, move forward, next time around do a better job, versus failure as that's just define the limits of how far I can go, and I can go no further. And that's a critical mindset. A mindset isn't hardwired any more than entrepreneurial ability is hardwired. It's the kind of thing you can work on and educate yourself around and try to reposition through experience. But approaching failure, and I mean even small failures, setbacks, somebody didn't like that version of a product or they didn't like it in that color, don't treat it as a I'm not good enough to succeed signal. Treat it as a what can I learn from this little experiment and make it better the next time.
Stuart Thornhill is a professor of business administration at the Ross School of Business. He's also the executive director of the Samuel Zell and Robert H. Lurie Institute for Entrepreneurial Studies. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
We'd like to end each conversation on the next idea with a question to discuss. What can people do in their own neighborhoods or in their own communities to encourage entrepreneurship? I mean, what's worked for you? Let us know your thoughts in the comments under the essay at our website, michiganradio.org, or on Michigan Radio's Facebook page, or on Twitter at NextIdeaMI.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. It has been 2 years since those protests. That's when the legislature in lame duck session passed Michigan's right to work law. It went into effect a few months later. Lawmakers and the governor argued it was only fair that union workers could decide whether they actually wanted to pay dues to the union. They also assured us that businesses would move to Michigan if it became a right to work state. Union leaders and others said, look, let's call this what it is, a ploy to weaken unions and a maneuver by Republicans to defund unions, which often give to Democratic candidates. The question is this: what effects these 2 years later have we seen since Right to Work came to Michigan? Joining us to discuss that is Patrick Anderson, CEO of Anderson Economic Group, and Charles Ballard, an economics professor at Michigan State University. So I've read that last year union membership in raw numbers actually went up a little bit, although because of greater job growth overall in the state, the percentage is a little lower. It's hovering around 16%, just above 16%. Just recently, Emily Lawler at MLive reported Sparrow Home Health Nurses voted to unionize. The American Federation of Teachers picked up some numbers. So, Patrick, what's that tell you about unions and the right to work?
It tells me that the effect of right to work is pretty much what we predicted 2 years ago and 4 years ago. Right to work, this simply that it allows unions, nothing stops people from organizing unions, but it prevents unions from compelling others to pay dues if they don't want to. So it's a voluntary union. Clearly the effect of that is it weakens the ability of unions to compel other people to pay dues. That's explicit. I think that's a moral issue. A lot of other people do too. And at the same time, it unavoidably affects the political power of unions because they can't compel people to pay dues who don't willingly do that or voluntarily do that. And in terms of the economics effects, it's pretty much exactly as we expected. It sent a signal across the country that Michigan's business climate was improving. It sent a signal that the power of organized labor unions was in decline. And it sent a signal that it was a little bit better business climate, particularly for companies that did work in unionized industries.
We'll take a look at some of those issues in a little more depth later. Charlie, are the unions at this point hurting any more because of Michigan's right to work?
Unions have been in decline for a very long time, for better or worse. 50 years ago, 45% of Michigan's workers were members of a union. It's declined essentially steadily to, as you mentioned, about 16% now. Patrick mentioned three times. He mentioned it as a signal. He never said anything about any actual jobs coming to Michigan, and that's because there is scant, if any, evidence that there's really been any change. The reason for that is unions were already weak, and if you're anti-union, that's a great triumph, and if you're pro-union, that's a sad thing. Unions have been losing ground for a very, very long time. The Right to Work law passed 2 years ago was not a sudden shift. Rather, it was a sort of a ratification of something that had already happened. When we became a right-to-work state, we had already sunk to the levels of unionization that many of the longtime right-to-work states, like, for instance, Louisiana, had a few decades ago. So for better or worse, unions are not very strong. I was at the governor's Economic Outlook luncheon last week. I asked specifically any effect of right to work, and they said none that they could detect.
How can we determine, for both of you, how can we determine if we've attracted any employers and jobs because of right to work? Because most of that information was anecdotal. The governor and some Republican leaders said that companies had approached them and said, you know, we're worried about you not being a right to work state, and now that that's changed, are we going to be able to measure it if it's just all anecdotal evidence?
I think Charlie's observation of what I said is exactly correct. I said it sent a signal because it does send a signal, and there's scant evidence of exact jobs coming here because there's scant evidence of exact jobs coming here. There's a couple reasons for that, and the most prominent is Michigan was off the list for a lot of large manufacturers in particular. Now it's back on the list. It takes those kind of companies a few years to actually consider moving jobs here. And so I think the effect goes over a long term. And the other part, second reason, is that unions have not been strong in the service industries or the areas of the economy that have been growing. And there's a bunch of reasons for that, including the preferences of the workers in those industries, including the organization and technology in those industries. That's where the majority of the job growth is. And so if you look out there, you wouldn't expect, and we never predicted, that the passage of right to work would have an immediate measurable effect in terms of employment. That was unlikely. The primary effect is it sends a signal, and it also changes the terms for individual employees that, because of their own views, do not want to pay union dues. And it's a very big effect for them. But in terms of aggregate employment, very hard to figure out in a short time frame if there's a positive or negative aggregate employment gains.
This seemed like such a pressing issue as the Republicans presented it in the Capitol 2 years ago. But a recent Wall Street Journal article found right to work has faded as a top priority for some Republican governors, such as Wisconsin's Scott Walker and Ohio's John Kasich. The argument is we had to become more competitive in the Midwest when the Republicans were explaining why right to work was important for Michigan. Why is it now not so important to our neighbors?
I think that the argument that was made that this would make a, I mean, at least some folks made an argument 2 years ago that right to work would be a shot in the arm to the Michigan economy. And I've suggested that probably it won't and hasn't. Certainly it hasn't been. Probably won't be. I don't say that there couldn't be any job gains as a result of it, especially in certain sectors. But I think that the case was overblown when it was made 2 years ago. I think, in fact, it was overblown on both sides. Those who advocated for the change made it sound as if we would have a dramatic renaissance of economic activity in Michigan. No evidence to believe that that would be true. On the other hand, those who argued against it sometimes made it sound like it was the end of the world. And in fact, unions have maintained their membership. As Patrick pointed out, the right to work law does not ban unions. It just changes the conditions under which unions can organize.
I wanted to ask about that. Were the claims by the anti-right-to-work protesters a little too hyperbolic?
I think so. That's my view.
And I'll just chime in. I did a quick Google search this morning of impact of right-to-work, and among the first half dozen, here's something from the National Education Association, and where the first word in the title is poverty, and where it says that the purpose is to destroy labor unions or freedom of collective bargaining, and then it says it lowers the standard of living. Here's one from the AFL-CIO, and again, this isn't rhetoric shouted. This is something on their website in writing right now. They lower wages and living standards for all workers in the state, from the AFL-CIO. And from the EPI, which is a labor-funded think tank, right-to-work laws do not boost job growth in states that adopt them, and they lower wages.
I wanted to ask you, there was a Michigan Capital Confidential article from the Mackinac Policy Center, which is a free market think tank, an anti-union think tank, I think it's fair to say. It noted the unions promised payback in the November elections, and now those threats, quote, ring hollow after the Republicans did so well in November. Democrats certainly didn't turn out in droves in election 2014. In fact, right to work was hardly mentioned during the campaign. So what do you think of that Capital Confidential assessment?
I would take anything from Capital Confidential with a grain of salt. They have a very, very strong slant. But, you know, it's true that Democrats did not do well in the election. And I think it's also true that right to work was a non-issue. I didn't see any, there may have been some, but I didn't see any candidates making that a centerpiece of their campaign, either the Republicans or the Democrats.
Patrick?
I mean, first of all, the Mackinac Center folks would not consider themselves anti-union. They'd clearly accept, though, the free market label. And I'll say I identified the clearly labor-supportive group as a labor-funded think tank, EPI, earlier. I think that's a fair way to assess them. And unavoidably, Democrats did extremely badly in the last election. The number one reason for that is probably what the public's opinion of Democrats, the Democratic president, health care law, lots of other things, way, way down on the list was right to work. And I think the Mackinac Center's Capital Confidential columnist there said what a lot of people observe, which is, and by playing the sounds of the protest earlier in the show, you're in effect underlining the claims that the public would be outraged by the passage of right to work and throw out the politicians that put that into law were clearly way, way, way overblown. And in essence, the public came down to thinking pretty much the way Charlie said, that they accepted it, and it wasn't that big of an issue for them.
So that anger kind of disappeared. It's not really manifested itself in political action.
I'm not sure how much anger there was actually among the average citizen. A lot of those protests, as we know from some of the law enforcement actions, involved people that were bussed in to protest, and some of the violence, which is completely unacceptable in my view, was perpetrated by some of those folks. And that's not to say they don't have a view. They do have a view, but that's not the reflected view of the large number of Michigan citizens.
I do want to chime in with one thing. You know, you mentioned the effects of unions on incomes, and I think some of the rhetoric that you read, Lester, was overblown. But, you know, there is research on the effects of unions over the long haul, and unions, especially in the middle of the 20th century, were a part of a whole series of trends that led to a great equalization of incomes and helped boost the incomes of some groups of sort of lower middle income workers. And then in the last 40 years, they've become a lot weaker. And we have seen that there has been the biggest economic phenomenon of my lifetime has been the phenomenal increase in income inequality. And the deunionization is, I think, only a small part of that. There are a lot of other factors that go into it. But I don't think we should disparage the effects that unions at least once had in terms of supporting the workers. I mean, if you like the weekend and if you like the eight-hour day, you can't be too much anti-union.
Let's bottom line this. We mentioned that it's been less than 2 years that it's been in effect. Of course, many union contracts lasted past that point and really weren't affected by this. If we haven't noticed any dramatic differences as of yet, when, if ever, will we in passing the right to work law in Michigan?
I think it remains to be seen. It could be we might see some evidence in a few years. Although this is likely to be small relative to the swings of the national economy. If we look at the phenomenal growth of Michigan manufacturing in the 90s and then its big slide in the 2000s and then its recovery in the last few years, those have an awful lot to do with things like the national macroeconomy, the global competitive issues in the auto industry, and the price of oil. And it's hard to detect much of an effect of things like unionization on the overall job growth in the state.
Patrick, you get the last word.
As we had predicted and as we'd advised our business clients and as well as politicians 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, right to work is a very strong signal. I think that signal has been sent. Signals take a while to take effect. It will be hard for us to see businesses. I doubt any businesses are going to volunteer that they came here primarily because of right to work, even if that's the case. So it's going to be extremely difficult for us to identify specific employers or jobs. I do not think, and I guess Charlie and I agree on this, that you're going to see any data that show that it dramatically increased or dramatically reduced or even marginally increased or reduced Michigan's employment in the short term. But I do think it has a positive effect because of the general signaling it sends to the rest of the nation and to employers that Michigan is a much more employer-friendly state and the business climate is better. And I think that's overall positive.
That's Patrick Anderson. He's the CEO of Anderson Economic Group. And Charles Ballard, an economics professor at Michigan State University. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're coming up on an anniversary this weekend. It's probably not one you've noted before. On December 14th, 1799, the nation's first president, George Washington, died at his home, Mount Vernon. It was not an easy death, primarily because of the medical treatments he was given. Dr. Howard Markell is a physician and medical historian at the University of Michigan, and he's written an essay about that. So the former president gets sick, someone calls the doctor. What happened from there?
Well, you know, it all started on a cold, frigid afternoon in Virginia. It was December 13th when things started. George Washington was on horseback overseeing the activities at Mount Vernon.
Probably fox hunting.
No, actually just seeing what was growing and planting, and he actually caught a cold.
So the doctor was called, reached the house, I assume, a few hours later.
Yes, several hours later. First, Washington's regular physician, a man named James Craig, who treated him for over 40 years, came, as well as a bloodletter. It was the overseer on the estate, a man named Rawlins, who removed about 14 ounces of blood. Bloodletting was a major treatment back then.
That's always a great start to strengthen you.
Well, yeah, it's really based on a Hippocratic treatise of the four body humors,
right?
Blood, yellow bile, black bile, and phlegm. And the thought was that there was too much blood. He was over-sanguine. It was causing the inflammation in his throat.
They also used some other treatments that caused him some pain.
Yes. The doctor gave him blister of cantharides, which we know better as Spanish fly. It's an insect. But when you mash it up or crush it up and put it in a solution, it really raises a huge blister on human skin. And that was a concept called counter-irritation, that if you raised a blister, you would draw out the bad humors that were inflaming the particular body part in question.
So he dies not too much longer out after another treatment, some kind of poisonous compounds and so forth. What did he actually die from?
This is what doctors have been arguing since probably 5 minutes after Washington died. Certainly the treatments didn't help. And for a long time, the trope was the doctors bled Washington to death. And that's not completely untrue. But what he probably had was something called acute epiglottitis, which is caused by Haemophilus influenzae, a bacteria that we now have a great vaccine for, so we rarely see it at all. And it basically inflames the back of the throat so much that you suffocate, that you cannot breathe and you die.
I read an article recently that an architect also showed up at Mount Vernon just after the president's death and pleaded with Martha Washington to allow him to set up a transfusion of lamb's blood into Washington's dead body in an effort to reanimate it. She declined the offer. Was that something that was commonly attempted, or was this cutting-edge technology at the time?
No, I think you'd call it quack medicine. But another physician who came after the death wanted to freeze Washington's body with the hope of somehow reanimating it as well. Washington insisted, by the way, one of his last wishes was, don't bury me until 3 days after I'm dead. So maybe he had those ideas in mind.
Okay, thanks very much. Dr. Markell is a medical historian and a physician at the University of Michigan. Stateside's executive producer is tyrant of interviewing etiquette, Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Zach Dieterman, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, and Annie Norris. The program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.